then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's November the 20th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, still not 100% recovered from the crud, which is hanging on a little bit longer than it usually does, probably due to my advancing age. But I need to talk to you folks this week about something, and so any outbursts of convulsive coughing on my part that occur today, I will simply edit out with WavePad. Oh, we had something happen over the weekend, which is probably going to become almost typical in times to come. Now, as I recall, some months ago, Andy and I both received some preliminary email contact from a guy who was living outside the homeland, I want to say in Texas. He said he wanted to come home, but for this reason or that reason, he could not or did not want to receive an introductory packet. Now, I honestly cannot remember the details. I get so many of these half-assed contacts from people who never get back to me. He didn't want to get an intro pack either because he didn't have a stable mailing address, which a lot of young white men don't these days, or he was staying with his family, or someplace where his mail was subject to hostile interception and monitoring, which is another situation that young white men often find themselves in, as absurd as that sounds, or whatever the excuses were, I can't even remember, because this was almost a year ago. I had one or two emails from him, and I never heard from him again. Common experience. Okay, fast forward to about 10 days ago. All of a sudden, we get an email from him. Hi, guys, remember me? Well, here I am, me and my wife, right here in the homeland, and I want to meet with you guys. Oh, by the way, we still don't have a stable mailing address because we're living in this motel down on the coast of Washington, but still, we want to come up and meet with you wonderful comrades of the Northwest Front. Now, as it happens, one of our guys was able and willing to drive down to the coast last weekend and meet with this young couple, despite the fact that we didn't really know them from Adam's house cat. Now, he did so. He met with them. He reported back to me, and he was actually fairly impressed with these two young people. They explained to him in great detail their whole long, stereotypically American story of treachery, chaos, and dysfunctional space madness that led to their ending up in a motel on the Washington coast in the middle of winter. Just about every young white person of either sex has a story like that these days. These two are apparently a good deal more squared away than all of this sounds, and our guy gave them a definite upcheck, so we're going to wait until these two get employed and stable with an address, and then they will begin the Northwest Front vetting process as if they were complete newcomers. But as a result of all this, Andy suggested that it was time for me to review the entire Northwest Front contact process yet again from the top. I say again, there is no such thing as a quote-unquote member of the Northwest Front. We do, however, have an established protocol for processing, vetting, and bringing new contacts online in the older sense of the term. Basically, to make sure, if at all possible, that no one walks through our door without us having at least some idea of who they are and where they've been. Now, the first step in this process is that we need to get a name and a postal mailing address from a new internet contact. The address can be a post office box or a PMB number, that's fine. Just some place where the post office will deliver mail and the individual can receive it securely. And we very often get this excuse of, oh, I live with non-racial relatives who would get upset, so please don't send me any mail. Well, maybe this is true. Maybe this is because the contact is simply afraid of giving out an address because bad men in expensive suits might come knocking on his door, and yeah, that might happen. Maybe something else is going on. Yes, I get that bad, dysfunctional economic and social stuff happens fairly often in Obama's America, and that young people in their mid and late 20s, and sometimes older, can find themselves for real living in their parents' basement because there's no place else to go. But if that's the case, you need to somehow find the money to rent a post office box or a private mailbox. For half a century, the first requirement for participation in white nationalism of any kind has been a secure mailing address which is not subject to hostile interception and monitoring. I got my first post office box when I was 16 years old. You must be able to receive mail and read it and digest it in privacy and security. Now get a P.O. box or UPS store drop box, or else get back to us when you have one. Now that's your starting point. No matter how bright and interested you sound, there is a time limit on how long we will continue to deal with a faceless email address where we have no idea of who we're really talking to. The name needs to be a full name, not just Joe or Veronica or an acronym from some little Hollywood Nazi group with all of three members, two of whom probably don't even know that they're members. Now, in the first place, the post office usually will not deliver mail without a full name. No, they won't. And don't tell me they will, because I've tried. Mail packets are expensive, and every time one is returned marked undeliverable as addressed, we're out of money. And in the second place, the refusal to supply a full name shows me that somebody's trying to jack us around from the get-go. And he's most likely an ICI, an Idle Curiosity Inquiry, a looky-loo trying to get some free stuff, which is a very common attitude in the movement. Okay, fair enough. I understand that most people who inquire are only looky-loos. I'm willing to expend a white book and an intro pack on them to satisfy their curiosity and let them know that, yes, there is hope. But internet games playing from the very start is a red flag. There is a difference between a looky-loo who might turn out to be a comrade and an internet troll. We get a lot of trolls, and one of the first marks of a troll is they never give up a physical location. Or when they do, it's false. Now remember, the Northwest Front is the real thing. Paranoia has to stop, and trust has to start somewhere, and it starts with you. If you don't trust us, then we don't trust you. Your intro packet will include a copy of the Northwest Migration Manual, otherwise known as the White Book. Now that's one reason why all the intros for the past 10 days are late. We got so slammed that I ran out of white books. More are on the way with fall building campaign money, but we didn't have enough money for me to check the box that said expedited shipping, so cases of white books are still wandering in this direction across the landscape from the East Coast by UPS slowboat during the holiday season. I should be able to start sending intros out again this week. Okay, and I'm rambling. Speaking of the White Book, this manual is specifically written and designed to answer your questions. This manual is important. Reading it is the very first thing that you need to do before you approach us with individual specific questions, because most of them will be answered there. Read it carefully and study it. It contains the answers that you claim to be seeking. The Northwest Independence novels are even more so written to answer your questions, and my own view is that you need to have read at least a couple of them before proceeding. Pelting us with emails asking questions which are clearly answered in the literature that you were sent, and which shows that you haven't actually read it, do not impress. Now, I apologize if all this sounds a bit crotchety, but we're starting to get enough new people interested to where our time is being wasted by trolls, and we need to cut this to a minimum. Now, the next step after receipt of an individual packet is internet or snail mail correspondence. During this period, you'll be looked over, first and foremost, for basic compos mentis, and after that, for intelligence, communication skills, presentation, and general personality and cop-on. Then comes chat rooms, bulletin boards, then possibly phone calls. Now, I do not give out my phone number extensively, because if I did, I would spend 7 or 8 hours per day talking to people on the phone who are essentially calling because they're lonely, and they want to chat to a fellow white nationalist. Understandable. But I really need to use that time for other things, so please no one take offense. One day, when we have more people who are willing to make total life commitment, we can have such things as NF phone numbers with duty officers like we had back in the day. I never respond to imperious and peremptory demands that I call a total stranger at such and such a number. There is no surer way to be written off as a kook or worse. Anything you need to say to me can be said via email. If it can't be said in a written and government-monitored format like email, you probably shouldn't be saying it. Yes, I know, it's hard assuming that everything you write in an email goes right to the NSA and FBI, but according to Edward Snowden, that's the case, and whether we like it or not, this is the second decade of the 21st century, and we have to use email and phone texting to communicate. People have basically simply forgotten how to write letters, looks like. Just learn to deal with the fact that we are living and working in a goldfish bowl. Remember my story that I've told you several times about the Russian Okhrana and how they failed, and drive on. You will need to give the party a short introduction and bio. Anything you say can and will be used for an actual background check. The NF is unique in the movement in that we actually do check people out. And I don't just mean Googling somebody's name, although you'd be surprised at what you can turn up just with that. In view of who we are and what we envision for the future, it is entirely logical and reasonable for me and the other NF people to want to know who the hell we're talking to when we sit down together. A photograph of yourself and your wife, husband, or significant other will be helpful, as well as any children. Suffice it to say that we have, on past occasions, turned up some unpleasant surprises along that line, and no, it is not all right to be married to a Chinese woman. I once considered flat out asking for social security numbers and dates of birth, but I recognized that there would be legitimate security concerns with that. While I don't know you, neither do you know me, and considering all the horse shit on the internet that has been written about me by weirdos, a request for a social security number would probably fuel the goat dance and make it worse. Besides, if you're really a federal cop or an SPLC spy of some kind, that could easily be faked. Our vetting procedures are mostly designed to weed out kooks, dysfunctionals, NGO spies, not the secret police themselves. However, I admit that we find the voluntary submission of Social Security number and date of birth impressive. If you really want to get off on the right foot with us, that's definitely a step in the right direction. The system is crude and imperfect, and the FBI or whoever could dummy up a fake background easily, but I intend to force them to do just that. These people are getting paid taxpayer money to violate the Constitution, and I mean to make them work for it. I mean to make them cover all the bases, dot their I's, and cross their T's. Never make anything easier for these people who are spying on us and seek to do us harm. Now, our present vetting system isn't perfect, not at all, and like I said, it could easily be circumvented by someone who is seriously trying to get close to us in order to do harm. We're doing it for two reasons. A, to get ourselves used to the concept of doing things correctly and competently as revolutionaries, something that white Americans have no previous experience in. And B, to weed out movement kooks and dysfunctionals of the kind whom the late Pam Emmerich described as not cops, not kikes, not spies, just trouble. Among other things, I'm specifically looking for past movement background. Obviously, we can't and won't disqualify everyone who has ever taken part in other groups' activities just for that reason, but I need to have a general idea of who you've been hanging with on the internet and otherwise, and what kind of movement contaminants and toxicities you may have picked up. Yes, this is important. I need to know what baggage you are bringing to the Northwest Front. Then, finally, comes actual meeting. Now, the first meeting should be a one-on-one with myself or some other senior person whom I trust to make the evaluation. The idea here is to put a face to the URL and the email address to make sure that you really exist, that you really are white, and that you're not, in fact, the holy Rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from Temple Schmuckel jacking us around on the internet. A crap like that's happened before, although not to me and not to the NF. Once someone has been met individually and checked for all of the basics, i.e. white skin, no obvious Negroid or Asiatic racial characteristics, no grossly Semitic face, someone is of sound mind, they're not falling down drunk or high, no body odor, no tics, no obvious indications of mental instability, so forth and so on. Only then do you get invited to a larger meeting and get to meet some of the others. I really wish things were different, but this is the reality we have to live with. The basic rule is no strangers walking through the door. At least that's the rule insofar as we can enforce it. Bear in mind that these few simple protocols are the result of many years of bitter experience. including many years of prison time for some of us. These rules are for your protection just as much as ours. Everyone on this list should ideally be involved in some stage of the above process I've just described. If not, you need to get started. Yes, I know I've played this song several times in the past, fairly recently, but in view of the topic, I think it's appropriate.
Comrades. Tonight, I'm going to be discussing Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique. And this is dealing with the critique of Western culture. This has come from individuals who identify as Jews and are working for Jewish group evolutionary strategy. So this does not involve all Jews, and Gentiles can be involved as a cover. In fact, they're often sought out by these groups. McDonald starts out by talking about the North Eurasian circumpolar area. This is a group that tended to evolve to have monogamy and bilateral kinship and exogamous marriage. So it tends to be a more individualistic strategy. And in this group, there has a tendency to be something called altruistic punishment. And this is a form of shunning those who are less than altruistic. And then you have the middle old world culture area where you have extended kinship, you have polygamy, and you tend to have society segmented into groups. Prior to the year 1800, most or really all Jewish intellectuals had a tendency to be in their own little world and tended to review our religious text, and that's really all that they did. But as a result of the Enlightenment, by 1800, you had a lot of Jews coming out into the wider social and geopolitical world. Now, one of the strategies that the Jewish people or the intellectuals really found helpful was the strategy of communism. I used to think that a lot of communists are Jews, but rather I think what tended to happen is that there are a lot of Jews who pretended to be communists. Now, when you start to talk about Marx disliked nationalist groups that had a unified, hierarchical, but harmonious relationship. And this was mainly because ethnic identification is not about class conflict. And of course, in addition to that, Marx was also Jewish. Now, as any society becomes highly organized, Jews can tend to be seen as foreign. And honestly, sometimes Jews don't know how Jewish they are. They can engage in self-deception as well. Now, sometimes regimes, such as the communist regime, would use Jews and maybe gypsies to punish local people because it was known that these groups had a less connection to the average local person. In the West, we also have this influence of Freud and the Frankfurt School. Freud tended to pathologize anti-Semitism and tended to say that anything such as anti-Semitism would be caused by psychosexual maladjustment, jealousy, or some sort of personal or collective trauma. And one of the traumas that Freud talks about was the conversion of once pagan Europeans. So between Freud and the Frankfurt School, whites who were concerned with status tended to be psychopathologized, and also Freud and other psychoanalysts who were influenced by Freud tended to encourage promiscuity. Now, over time, in communist areas, there was a tendency for Jews to depart from communism because communism started to be seen as only so-so for Jews, and of course, nationalist regimes were no good, and even democracy was questionable. So then you start to have the neocons who started to encourage interracial marriage, but also realized that in rural areas, many whites were strongly Christian. So they maintained this support or supposed support for Christianity in order to get whites to believe that the neocons were really on their side. Now, in other areas of the country, you had the New York School, where you had the New York Jewish intellectuals. They tended to work for unrestrained immigration from the 1920s onward. They tended to argue that any restrictions on immigration were rooted in Nordicism and were morally wrong. And they really advocated unrestrained immigration for America, Europe, Australia, and Canada. But of course not for Israel. Now, one of the things that McDonald acknowledges would have worked for Gentile groups that wanted to maintain a Northwestern European balance or even a European balance in general, that they should have had a better understanding and a better utilization of Darwinism as a theoretical framework. Unfortunately, Darwinism was not fully utilized, and so this idea of border defense or maintaining a certain ethnic biological state within the United States and also Europe and other places tended to fall to individuals who were more rural, who were involved with perhaps small church groups or other types of organizations that were poorly funded and also tended to attract people who are less educated. And as a result, the whole idea of restrained immigration never had the same sophistication that it would have had had it been based on Darwinism. Of course, McDonald advocates that whites become accustomed to between group competition and realize that there are these group evolutionary strategies that whites are ill-suited to compete with if they do not understand the nature of these strategies that other groups use with ease, but that whites seem poorly equipped to navigate, probably just because of the evolutionary history of the circumpolar area. So Donald really hopes that whites will unify because he sees that as the only hope for really competition, having true competition that is viable. Otherwise, McDonald predicts that whites will honestly be unable to compete. So to sum it up, the best strategies seem to be nationalism, Darwinism, and just group awareness. Those are really the only ways to compete. So thank you for listening to my review. Now you have to realize this book is not a quick read, especially not on Kindle. There's an exhaustive amount of information, so you may find that tedious, but if you stick with this book, you learn a lot. So, good evening and hail victory, comrades.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andreas Donner here. I'm sure you're all sick of election recap stuff, but there are a few interesting observations begging to be drawn from particular national and Washington state results. This democracy thing doesn't ever pan out, and in the instances I'm going to cover today, it's actually become clear why. And yes, I'm quite familiar with all of the historical observations made by learned men regarding people voting themselves largesse from the public treasury. All those thoughts are perfectly true and will remain so. Nevertheless, democracy has taken on a bizarre new twist in modern society, which warrants exploration. In the recent past, prior to this election cycle, a WOG elected to the Seattle City Council agitated for and won a citywide $15 an hour minimum wage law. Obviously, that's insane. But the local reaction was even more insane. Local print media has an obvious bias, but they couldn't quite keep certain facts from being brought to public attention. Finding anyone opposing the ridiculous wage hike wasn't on the agenda, but the fact that it was going to hurt local businesses was on full display. One small business owner who operates a chain of touristy boutique-style cupcake shops was quite public with their support for the $15 an hour law, but followed up with the observation they would have to close a location because of it. I know that doesn't compute. But it's not the only absurd thing we've done here, which makes no objective sense. By now, you've probably heard that Washington State had a couple of ballot initiatives which dealt with firearms. One of them required all firearm transfers taking place in the state to involve a background check. Without getting into all the details of the dumb things the initiative does, the core idea is still wrong. No shooting event, especially the Marysville school shooting north of Seattle over a week prior to the election, would have been stopped by the new initiative or any other firearm law. In fact, none of the shootings were ever stopped by any laws because, well, they weren't stopped. But is this common knowledge among the voting population of the state? Of course it is. In fact, all of the leftist kooks in the local media, print and otherwise, are all too happy to admit no legal measure will ever prevent a shooting. Further, everyone discussing the subject agrees on this fact. But here's the rub. The useless and ineffective background check is, quote, a step in the right direction, unquote. Of course, that phrase has no real meaning because the law accomplishes nothing. It's a step in no direction. With that said, I'll get off the subject of gun laws, since if I stay here any longer, I'm going to lose the audience. Moving on to the national scale, I notice the Republican Party has made quite a bit of noise about how they can't possibly be racist, because they're electing and re-electing darkies all over the place. Bobby Jindal, who is actually named Piyush Jindal, of course, has been governor of Louisiana for some time, and Nikki Haley, who, by the by, was born Nimrata Randhawa, governs South Carolina. But the elections of Mia Love, Tim Scott, and Will Hurd to Congress should raise a few eyebrows. It's true that Love was elected in Utah, but Hurd was a Texas candidate, and Scott will represent South Carolina. For the South to elect niggers to Congress isn't entirely unheard of, but the Republican Party only managed to pull this off, with very rare exception, shortly after the American Civil War. Why all of this now? The Republican machine's decision to tolerate non-white politicians was made because Republicans have to look like they're, quote, moving in the right direction, unquote. And oddly enough, Nigger Senator Tim Scott agrees. A Business Insider article records Nigger Scott bragging that, quote, the South has made so much progress, unquote. The Republicans have heard the message loud and clear. Either they get on board, or they don't look like good people. And that's what democracy is all about. If you don't run and elect darkies, you're not a good person. The common theme among each of these elections is that people will use their political power as a fashion statement to put their own variety of goodness on display for the rest of the world to see, regardless of whether or not the display is pointless or even self-destructive. We all know about various species of animal which will make social displays in exchange for credibility with their social group. Most human beings do the same thing, and it almost always involves a measure of self-righteous morality deemed to be worthy of respect. Whether it's damaging your personal and local economy to demonstrate you're not elitist, or supporting useless and obnoxious legislation to prove you oppose violence, or even empowering your racial enemies because you need to prove you're progressive, politics is not the place for it. Now that I've made my point, I want to do a little spaced repetition on a related subject which doesn't seem to resonate, and I desperately need all of you to start getting it. The entire white nationalist movement is obsessed over waking people up to something everyone is perfectly well aware of. Just like in all these cases, no one really disagrees with us about race and other issues. But like I discussed in my Real Politics talks, human nature is such that facts don't matter. I can't think of any clearer set of examples to prove the point. And because of this, every white nationalist should be able to admit to themselves that they personally are responsible for coming home and working the Butler Plan, or else our race will cease to exist. The movement, for the little bit of good it's brought us, has more or less contented itself with shouting various facts from the rooftops which are readily available if anyone were to care about them. Which, by the by, they don't, and I've demonstrated that at least half a dozen ways now. Each and every white nationalist drives themselves nearly insane, because the rest of the white population won't up and... well, whatever it is the current white nationalist goal seems to be. I had really hoped by now this would have worked its way out of our collective system, since that's what would have to happen for our special little subculture to realize there won't be an end to white genocide otherwise. You can't expect other people to do what you're not willing to, after all. And lastly, I'm fully aware this is well past a week overdue, and I apologize. But as is pointed out from time to time, we are tasked to capacity up here. Would some of you mind helping change that? Hail victory, comrades.
This is Mike Cross.
I was just 16, the oldest son, when my mama called to me. She said, here's $10 and your daddy's watch and the Bible of the family. Now the mule's been sold, I'm feeling old, we got to find another town. You better leave and find you a better life before the family drags you down. And she said, is the whole paint peeling and the rats are squealing, the well gone dry as a bone. Crops are picked, I'm a feeling lit, and we got to be moving on. The whole paint peeling, the rats are squealing, there ain't no time for school. I never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. I took that money and I ran away, but I stopped to see that girl of mine. I gave a preacher $10 just to tie the knot, right after we crossed the state line. I got a job sharing crops for a rich Georgia farmer. I was young and I was strong. Tried to find a better life, but it won't no time till the kids started coming along. And they were singing, old paint peeling and the rats are squealing, the well gone dry as a bone. Crops are picked, I'm a feeling lit, and we got to be moving on. Our old paint peeling, the rats are squealing, there ain't no time for school. Never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. Years went by, going town to town, working hard. Keep away the cold. My children had to help me bring the crops in, cause I was getting old. And then one night I heard my wife calling to my oldest son. She said, here's $10 and your daddy's watch, you better leave before the rising sun. And she said, it's the old paint peeling and the rats are squealing, the well gone dry as a bone. Crops are picked, I'm a feeling late, and we got to be moving on. Our old paint peeling, the rats are squealing, there ain't no time for school. I never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. Oh, you know I never wanted you to be like your old man, growing up a fool. Yeah, the old paint peeling. Yeah, the old paint peeling.
All right, welcome back. Episode 77 of The White Voice on The White Voice. Let me ask you, what do you think of this Ebola thing? A couple weeks ago, of course, we had Ebola finally hit here in New York. They were saying it's not airborne. I mean, we're facing all these all these problems quickly. Do you have any thoughts on Ebola?
I'm not a doctor, But my general view from what I just read on the internet is that any virus is capable of becoming airborne. But in the Middle Ages, the Black Death, which wiped out one-third of Europe, is called the bubonic plague. Actually, what actually did the killing was a pneumonic plague. Supposedly it came from the rats and the fleas, yes, but at some point in the human body, it transmuted into a pneumonic form, which is airborne. In other words, you didn't actually have to get bitten by an infected flea. You could actually pick it up from just, you know, breathing the same air as an infected person. And my understanding is that any virus is capable of becoming pneumonic. It's just they don't know whether or not Ebola is. It's certainly, they're certainly having a major outbreak of it in West Africa right now.
So it's something that they're bringing here, undoubtedly.
I think we're going to see happen with Ebola in another couple of weeks. The same thing that happened with those 300,000 Salvadorian and Honduran children that mysteriously appeared on our borders back during the summer. All of a sudden, you may have noticed they just dropped out of the news cycle.
Yeah.
They're no longer news. I think Ebola is going to disappear too, because the thing is that obviously if you've got an epidemic being brought in from another country, mm-hmm. the first thing you do is seal off your borders and stop incoming flights from the infected area. This goes back to the Middle Ages and the Black Death. They used to lock people up in their houses if they were infected. But
that would go against the tenets of their yeah. modern liberal agenda. You can't seal the borders.
Oh, yeah. It's almost like an underlying article of liberal faith. Whatever happens, you cannot seal the border. It doesn't matter if it's 300,000 kiddies running across the Rio Grande. Doesn't matter if it's Mexican drug cartels marching in formation down the streets of towns in Arizona. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's infected monkoids coming in from West Africa and spreading terrible diseases. And some other, it's not just Ebola. We have to worry about dengue, enteric fever, Nile fever, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, but you must not seal up the borders. That's evil and wicked and racist. And of course, since Ebola comes from Africa, it's racist against black people. Really, there are people who are going to die because of this.
Yeah.
Now, how serious it will ever get here in the United States, I don't know. We're just going to have to see. My personal theory is that very soon, again, after the elections, it's just going to disappear.
Let me ask you also quickly about ISIS. I seem to see there's evidence that this was generated by the government and funded by the government, but putting our tinfoil hats down for a second, this is truly one of those things that scares the shit out of me, and I'll drive everywhere now. I kind of refuse to take public transit anywhere. Because simply, I mean, 9/11, you can say whether the Bush did it or it was Israel or whether it was a couple of towel heads with box cutters. At the end of the day, those people jumping out of the building were very real, you know, and I don't know if you ever heard that video of the guy who, I should say the audio of a 911 call, and he was on the phone as the building was falling down on him. That is the kind of stuff that is made of nightmares. And if you haven't heard, anybody who's listening as well, if you haven't heard it, go look it up. I forget the guy's name, but it was one of the things that they played at the trial of the one guy that they actually prosecuted related to the attacks.
Yeah.
These things, whether or not who's doing it is real, they're very real. Bombs going off is real. We saw this little charade in Canada a couple weeks ago. What do you?
I should add, Mike. I'm sorry. I apologize for calling you Mike. I usually do the Mike Harris show. Anyway, Joe, just I want to mention that I lived in Ireland for 5 years, and I lived in London during the IRA bombing campaign of 91 and 92. And I was working as a bank security guard, and I was one of the first responders to what's called the Baltic Exchange bomb in 92. So I have actually seen what happens during these incidents.
It is terrifying.
Yes,
I mean, you'd admit it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you make of this ISIS thing? Do you see, I kind of originally, I mean, we're like a week away from a couple days away from the election at this point. I kind of saw something maybe happening so they can somehow tinker with the election, but I kind of think they'll just wait. I mean, what do you think? It's definitely related to the open borders. What do you make of it?
I think ISIS is not so much some sort of big conspiracy as it is a case of unintended consequences. At some point, the United States and Israel acting together decided they wanted to completely destabilize the Middle East, which they pretty much succeeded in doing in Iraq. They had decided that Bashar al-Assad in Syria has to go because he keeps demanding the Golan Heights back, and so they basically stirred up this revolt against him starting a couple of years ago. Remember the so-called Arab Spring, and what was it, 2011, when they got rid of the dictators in Tunisia, they got rid of Gaddafi, they got rid of Mubarak in Egypt, and they decided they were going to move on to Syria, and for reasons which I'm not totally conversant with.
I think it's related to
Bashar Assad was able to put up a fight, possibly with Russian help, but, and so now the Syria. Anyway, so what they did was they had all these little tiny groups of various Muslim guerrillas of various types. Some of them are genuinely Syrian rebels. They wanted to kill Assad. And some of them were Al-Qaeda, some of them were, you know, various weird jihadists. And the Israelis and the Americans and the CIA just went in there and loaded them all up with weapons. And they didn't apparently vet them in any way, not that you can. And so, yeah, ISIS is a monster created by the United States and the CIA and the Israeli Mossad. Just like bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and Hamas, they were originally created to fight the enemies of the United States and Israel in the region. And now they've just gone berserk and they've turned and bit the hand that fed them and turned on their masters. And so now, apparently, all we're doing is doing the same thing. We're looking around for so-called moderate Muslim guerrilla groups to actually do our fighting for us over there. That's not going to work.
But Howard, what do you make of these Americans and even some of these Brits that are, you know, they're growing beards and putting head garb on and screaming Akbar and all this stuff? I mean, that's pretty sick, too.
Well, I assume you're talking about white Britons and white Americans that are doing this. I think it is a form of mental illness in some white people that they are so anxious to see anybody actually fighting these SOBs that rule us.
Now, let me ask you this. What do you make of the Africans living in America? We saw the guy in Oklahoma a couple months ago. Of course, we saw this vermin in New York go after the cop. I'm not sure he was black, but we're starting this. I think blacks, I mean, I think Islam is a low IQ religion anyway. They're particularly attracted to this. Do you think that this can be a major part of whatever is to come in terms of racial conflict?
One thing you got to bear in mind, Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam is not actually proper Sunni or Shiite or any kind of Islam as well. That was one of the things that got Malcolm X assassinated. He actually went on the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, and some imam was talking to him and saying, look, you monkoids in America need to get through your heads that this gibberish you're talking about, white people were created by devils and this sort of stuff, this is not the Quran. This is the Quran. You need to read the Quran. If you want to be a Muslim, you need to be a Muslim and not this weird little Elijah Muhammad cult that you coons are running around with in the slums of Chicago. And Malcolm X actually came back from the Hajj and he decided, well, American monkoids really do need to be proper Muslims and not black Muslims, and that basically was what got him killed. So don't, you know, judge all of Islam by the ravings of Louis Farrakhan.
There are people
black,
doing it.
Black Islam is about like these jump and shout Negroid churches in the South are to proper Christianity. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Before we let you go, and anyone who wants to call in before a break, 857-232-0159, code is 345-925. Quick hit and run, yes, no answers. What will be banned in the Northwest American Republic? I think this will be interesting. I should have thought of more things before
We have a copy of our Constitution on the website. Lawyers will be banned. Professional clergy.
Well, hold on. Let me ask you two things, and then you can rattle off a few for me. First one, I think this is an interesting one. Contraceptives.
There's nothing about contraceptives in the Constitution.
What do you think of that, though?
Well, we have. I can't see why we would ban contraceptives completely, although we will encourage a high birth rate. Let's get to the whole cut. Chase with whole sex thing. You know, we're not going to create some kind of Puritan New England where women are stamped with the letter A if they commit fornication or whatever and people aren't burned at the stake. As far as I personally am concerned, someone's sex life is their own business up to a certain point. That certain point is that your partner must be of the same race and the opposite sex. Beyond that, I think it genuinely is nobody's business. Once you cross that line, yes, things like homosexuality, misogynation, and race mixing, etc., those are society's business. Those are not personal, private things. In the case of the Northwest Republic, since there won't be any non-whites, there won't be any opportunity for anybody to race mix. Homosexuality will be treated as a form of mental illness, which is what it is. And
what do they call them? Transgenders now, Harold? None of that?
No, that's not. Well, in a sane, healthy society, Joe, these things aren't going to exist.
Where do you think that comes from, Harold?
I get a lot of people saying, well, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about that? In a sane, normal society, these problems, they're not going to be around. We won't have to deal with them because the mental pathologies which are produced by liberalism and leftism and
all the drugs that they force down people's throats. Yeah, that too. I mean, you got to consider that. The other thing I wanted to ask you is alcohol. Last week on our show, we were talking about the 18th Amendment.
No, we're not going to have prohibition in the Northwest.
Okay, fair enough.
However, in my novels,
yes,
we have what's called, for the NVA, the Northwest Volunteer Army, we have what's called General Order Number 10. And in this, of course, totally fictitious uprising against the United States, the soldiers of the NVA are forbid to consume alcohol or smoke marijuana or any mind-altering substances, blah, 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 because basically you can't fight a revolution with a bunch of drunks. We have had bad experiences in our own movement through
And I personally think that marijuana is a major contributor to liberalism. I think, and you know, these white pot smoking vermin who just sit there all day reflecting on the patriarchy usually have a joint in their hand. But let me ask you this before I let you go. This is a totally blunt question. How the hell, I mean, maybe you're just a genius, but how did you develop? I mean, I'm sitting here, look, I'm a product of the 90s. I lived through this. How does someone, another human being, write a book? I mean, where do you get your creativity from to come up with these novels? I mean, look, it's one thing to sit here and write a formal organizational document. I can do that, okay?
Right.
Whether or not it'll be good or effective is, you know, another discussion. But I'm capable of doing that. But how does somebody write a novel about this and come up with these governing ordinances within the volunteer? How, Harold? What made you able to do that?
I've been writing since I was 11 years old. I'm the author of 20, 21 books, something like that. Of those, only 5 are Northwest novels. I also write normal fiction, but I think I understand your question. Before you can write, you first need to observe and know the world around you. It's kind of hard to say. In my case, these stories just start sort of eventually go whirling around in my head. And first I get a couple of characters, then I get a couple of scenes. And
do you sit there with a bottle of scotch and some ecstasy tabs? I mean, these are crazy.
No. The one thing, for all I know, writers have a reputation as very great drunks, but I don't recommend it. Basically, if you do that, first you'll find that you can't write without the booze, and then you'll find that you just can't write. But I observed a lot of this type of thing. I think we're talking about the Northwest novels here. I observed a lot of it from the sidelines in Ireland. I learned a lot in Ireland. I learned there how it's done. The Irish, for all their many problems with the provost and their left-wing ideology, fought a major Western democracy to a standstill and forced the British to buy them off. And so a lot of what I put in the Northwest novels is based on either my observations and adaptations of what went on in Ireland. A lot of it is based on simple history.
Because, hold on, if I can just interrupt, anybody who's not familiar with Harold who's listening, Harold is, I'm no Harold scholar, but from what I remember, lived all over the world, everywhere from Africa to, like you said, you were, last week you were telling, maybe it was this week you were telling us about your participation in protecting the banks in Ireland during the IRA bombings. I mean, these are the kinds of things. So it's really just shaped experience in many ways with, you know, writing skills, of course.
Yeah, well, wow. You need to write what you know. What I know is certain localities. You'll notice most of my books are set in places where I've personally been. What I know is history. And also, the first thing, if you want to write, you need to read. Now, this is something that I'm kind of worried about our younger generation. They don't read books anymore. Yeah. They look at the internet and they watch cable television and they watch DVDs. That worries me. But you got to bear in mind, I'm 61 years old and I am of a much older generation. We got our learning from books.
Yeah, not Kindles or YouTube videos. I mean, that's me. I can learn anything on YouTube. You know,
I guess that would be my major advice to anybody that wants to write books. First, you must read books, a lot of books.
Now, I don't know how many books Harold wants you to read.
You need to have a love of literature, literally.
I don't know how many books Harold wants you to read, but Harold, when did you send me books? A couple years ago. It's got to be by now, Harold. These are the, I have a small bookshelf, okay? And these are the kinds of books that you can only have about 2 or 3 of them on one shelf. So this is, I don't know if it's the writings of a genius, a madman, a great writer, I don't know, but these are things that you got to check out. Harold, quickly, where can everybody access your books?
Okay, where you need to go is www.northwestfront, all one word, northwestfront.org. Also, you can go to northwestfront.net. Those are our 2 primary websites. There's a section on each of those websites about the Northwest novels, but the novels themselves can be ordered from Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Alibris, a lot of other places. So the print for order publishing industry has become very much expanded since it first began about the year 2000. And it's made my work possible.
And you're not getting any letters from Chaim Schwitz from the publishing division of Amazon saying the books are hate speech yet, right?
This is very odd. No. The Southern Poverty Law Center has bitched about not just my books, but other books. A lot of guys have jumped on the bandwagon here, and they're writing their own. Now, like, for instance, if you're into Southern nationalism, Gregory Kay has written four Southern nationalist novels. A lot of nationalist authors have jumped on the bandwagon, and I think the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ADL have just decided that it's too big an industry to control, just like they can't control the internet. So, yeah, there have been a few rumblings from the left, but so far no one has attempted to seriously interfere with them.
Well, I'll let you stick to fiction. I'll stick to theoretical nonfiction, because sometimes I have strokes of genius myself, Harold. So,
okay.
Harold, it was a pleasure talking to you. We'll be right back after these words. Don't go anywhere.
This is the White Voice.
Okay, I have a bit of a confession to make. In the great computer crash of October, I lost a lot of my music, and now I'm kind of just playing little bits and pieces, some of which I've played before. Also, Amazon seems to have decided it's time to screw me, and so they've messed up the software, and so I'm having trouble downloading new songs from Amazon, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that's why the music probably seems a little bit haphazard over the past couple of weeks. This is a murder ballad that I found lying around on my hard drive that somehow survived the great October catastrophe. This is Cordelia's Dad.
Great. Greetings, comrades. This is the Trucker coming at you from the Trucker homestead here in the Northwest, enjoying an evening out in the hot tub. The clouds have moved off and quit raining, and I could actually see a few stars. And if you're anywhere near one of the big cities and stuff, you're going to be lucky if you can see any. On my way up from Las Vegas up here to the homeland, when I left on, the wife was driving out of Vegas Monday evening, and I started in a rest area up in the middle of Nevada, out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, you could, it's not quite the homeland, but it's close, but you can definitely see a lot of stars. And I was greeted as I was coming across Idaho out of Mountain Home. I just left the truck stop there, the pilot, and I had, as my wife put it, the brightest rainbow she had ever seen. We got to see both ends of it. Oh, what a glorious greeting back into the homeland. Yep, that made my Tuesday. And so, as the job entails, I have a lot of time either to listen to mindless drivel on the radio, or music, or I like listening to my different audiobooks and stuff, but I have a lot of time to listen to podcasts, and I've been catching up on back episodes of the Northwest Front, and I was just getting done listening to the segments. I think it was in 2011. It was right after the Brevik, Norway shootings and stuff, and I got to thinking about it while I was sitting out here in the hot tub. What are y'all gonna do when, oh, dumbass decides to go and institute martial law because of some terrorist attack here in the United States? How easy would it have been for ISIS, not that they're going to attack a fellow Muslim that's occupying our White House, but imagine if that guy that had jumped the fence and ran into the residence had been equipped with one of their suicide belts, and better yet, with some kind of, like, anthrax or some other kind of engineered thing to go along with the explosives and spread a little biological bomb right in the middle of Washington, D.C. Not that it would be any great loss, because, what, we'd end up losing a Kenyan and his monkoid wife and their cute little chipmunk children, or ape children, whatever, and some Secret Service traitors, as I like to look at it, because I honestly think they're harboring an enemy of the state and stuff. He does not belong in our White House, seeing as how we can't even come up with a birth certificate, which all the rest of us have to produce some kind of birth certificate. But not Obungo. No, of course not. The monkoid gets to do what the hell ever he wants. So, gee, would that have been a shame if he had been infected, or, better yet, made a martyr out of? Not that we really need that. Really set the monkoids off, and the apes going and burning down the city and all that, and have martial law instituted across the country, and then where y'all be? Yeah, I might be out there somewhere in the country, too, but I'm providing a necessary service, and I'm sure that I would be delayed, but the trucks would still be kept rolling in some kind of convoy, I'd imagine, to get the products to where they need to be and stuff. And seeing as how I'm more in the food service industry, I think they'd go and keep us going. But y'all be stuck where the hell ever you're at, in whatever concrete jungle behind enemy lines in occupied territory. Yeah, I really don't think you'd want to be there. Wouldn't it be so much nicer if you were here in the homeland, and if something happened, all you'd have to do is just get back to your house and lock it down, and you could be a whole lot safer than cowering in fear wherever you're at, listening to the monkeys go nuts, burning down the areas around you. So, what is holding you back anyway, comrades? Yeah, I know, I've been up here for a while, even longer than Mr. Covington has. But I'm here, you're not. Why not? So, make your scouting trip, pack up your assets, and get the hell up here. This is the Trucker, signing off.
They say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch a bandit run.
Okay, let me wind up with a few comments on coming current events, if I can do so before my voice finally gives out. Now, a number of you have asked me what I think about two things that look to be fairly certain to happen in the next few days. I'm now speaking, by the way, on the morning of Wednesday, November the 19th. First off, the grand jury in St. Louis is supposed to announce at any time now whether or not they're going to indict white police officer Darren Wilson for plugging the gentle giant last summer, as the aforesaid Munkoid was leaning into his car and trying to grab his gun, having just robbed a convenience store. The niggers are clearly expecting the grand jury not to return an indictment, and according to their own Twitter posts, they're openly getting ready to riot and burn down a specific list of targets, which they've tweeted to one another. Now, the first obvious comment is this. What the hell do you think would happen to the Northwest Front or any group of white people who tried something like this, who gathered in a specific place with the openly stated intention of breaking the law and attacking people of a different race and burning down public buildings? The regime would have the 82nd Airborne on the streets, and huge FBI task forces would be conducting sweeps to arrest anybody they could find. Some of us would probably end up in Guantanamo as so-called enemy combatants. I, for one, don't think it's completely out of the question that the cowardly grand jury and district attorney may actually indict the poor cop bastard as a pure act of appeasement, but if they don't, I guess we'll see whether or not the niggers are any better at walking the walk instead of talking the talk than we are. True, as a rule, niggers do have a somewhat better record of acting rather than talking than we do, Chris Dorner being an example in Los Angeles, but what they actually do is basically burn down their own neighborhoods. Sure, there are incidents like that poor guy Reginald Denny in L.A. who was dragged out of his truck and lynched, but the main risk to white people during these things is wandering into the wrong place at the wrong time. But the minute the Munkoids cross into the neighborhoods where the wealthy Democrats and liberals live, the hammer comes down, and I've noticed that they generally seem to know just how far they can go and get away with it. Now, my guess is that if there's no indictment of the white cop, then there will be some running around and yelling in the streets of Ferguson, and maybe a few burning liquor stores and check-cashing places and nappy-head hair salons, and the cops and the National Guard will arrest a few dozen or so, or a few hundred rioting niggers, all of whom will later be quietly released on payment of a small fine by Acorn or the SEIU or whoever sent all those coons down there. And the left-wing blogosphere will proclaim a great significant victory, and then everybody will move on to the next news cycle. The Obama amnesty thing is much more important in the long run, although, again, don't expect anything except the usual spectacle of the white man rolling over and exposing his belly in submission again like the whip dog he is. The dictator will finally have crossed the line, utterly and irrevocably ruling by imperial decree without the people's elected representatives, which is the most clear and blatant violation of the United States Constitution imaginable. Look up impeachable offense in the dictionary and you'll find see Obama amnesty in a picture of Barry. And not one goddamn thing will be done about it except a long round of sobbing and wringing of hands and tapping on keyboards. The spineless Republicans have already said that they will not impeach and they will not defund, so what the hell good are they? It's Lexington and Concord time at last. It's Fort Sumter time at last. It's an opportunity to fix the mistake that our forefathers made in Little Rock 60 years ago, and we will not take it. We will instead continue to hide in our basements with only the warm glow of the computer monitor for company, and we will wait for someone else to do it. Some of you will be waiting for me to do it. Now, I have told you what you have to do, people, and I will keep telling you. There is a plan. There is a way. We know what we have to do. We just won't do it. You want me to be your man on the white horse, flourishing my saber aloft and yelling charge like Teddy in Arsenic and Old Lace? And the hell of it is, as old and as sick as I am actually willing to do that, or at least attempt it. But you don't want to give me the white horse, or the saber, or the cape, or the bugle. I'm just supposed to make these things appear out of thin air, because I'm such a magic man. And as for charging behind me, oh, come on now. If I can't get you guys to make a perfectly legal and actually beneficial move to the Pacific Northwest as step one, what makes you think that you're ever going to quote-unquote stand and fight where you are? Sorry, guys, that ship has sailed. It sailed long ago while you were posting to Stormfront. But I can say this, we are heading for interesting times, and I believe that there's a few of you old-style white boys out there whose alpha gene hasn't been mutated into tapioca by a lifetime of World of Warcraft and pizza. Guys, I'm ready to do this thing when you are. And we'll see how it plays out. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Now, this is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and full bitter was their fate. Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow fill the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating heart in manhood's burning noon. Who could follow in their footsteps at the rising of the moon? At the rising of the moon.